This is The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. England are going to Qatar, qualification assured after scoring 10 brackets T-E-N, close brackets, against San Marino. Do we even dare talk about pre-qualifying? Is it interesting? Am I arrogant for wondering? What about the World Cup plate for smaller nations? And how many goals is a goal really worth in a 10-0? Is it time to apply Duckworth-Lewis to Harry Kane's international goal-scoring feats? Elsewhere, is there anything better than Ally McCoist at excitement level 9 as the Scots guarantee a home leg in the playoffs? Perhaps the joy at Windsor Park at holding the Italians, who now enter what is fast becoming the playoffs of death. Also, what's happening in African qualification as the South Africans protest the softest of soft penalties? An American has a very long question for Lars. There's a PhD inquiry, your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Jonathan Wilson. Hi, hello, how are you?
I'm very well, thanks. How are you?
Yeah, really good, thanks, mate. Ed Ahrens, welcome.
Hi, Max, how are you?
I am tremendous. Lars Sivertsen, good morning to you, sir.
Good morning, everyone.
Jonathan says, are there any easy games in international football? San Marino 0, England 10. England confirmed qualification with a big picture of lots of happy players and a lion. Pizza Express sent 3 clapping emojis, so that's important. Jack says, I don't know what's more amusing, the fact that ITV's score display clearly wasn't made for double figures, or the fact that I seriously said to myself, to be fair, if we'd had a decent ref, we'd have probably had 12. Max says, when do San Marino fans say enough is enough and start to question whether Franco Varela is really up to the job? And Brad says, instead of discussing the pros and cons of having smaller teams in World Cup qualification stages, can you instead just say England are good and move on to the juicy stuff? Well, let's start with this idea. We were talking about it before the pod. I don't know if it is. Is it interesting to talk about the idea of pre-qualifiers? Have we gone past that? Lots of people saying, please don't talk about that. Some people just saying, if you do talk about it, you're a terrible, arrogant Englishman. Jonathan, do you see yourself as a terrible, arrogant Englishman?
Oh, yes, on my better days.
Yeah. So what do you think should happen?
I mean, I think... I don't understand why pre-qualifying is such an issue. It's not that the smaller nations are denied their chance. It's that they have the chance, but only when they're good enough to possibly be able to do something. So, I mean, this happens in other confederations. You know, in Africa, you have a knockout to get down to the last 40. So the likes of Eswatini and Comoros, for instance, went out at that stage. Yeah, I don't think anybody particularly protests against that. I guess you come to a point of saying, okay, from a Sam Marinese point of view, what is the point of international football? If it is to make San Marinese football better, well, they've just lost 10-0 and they're ranked 210th out of 210 in the world. So they're not getting better. Varela's been in charge, I think, for 32 games now, of which he's lost 30 and drawn 2, which were against Gibraltar and another team at the tail end of last year. And it seems to me those are the fixtures where there's a value and a purpose to it, and they might get better, and you might get results, and you might be able to score goals, and that surely is the fun thing. I can't see, while there may be a thrill at playing against a Harry Kane or a Phil Foden or whoever, yeah, how much fun is it if you're losing every game 5-6-7-8-9-10-0? So I don't know what the problem is. I don't see why we couldn't, for this set of qualifying, rather than have some groups of 5 teams, some of 6, say, okay, they're all going to be 5-team groups, and the bottom 10 sides, would it be, would play off for 5 places. I just don't understand why people have a problem with that. I think it's arrogant, because we do it in every other competition. You know, you don't have the big teams only come into the FA Cup in the third round, but the small teams have a chance to get there because they have the rounds before that. I just don't understand why that is suddenly seen as arrogant when it comes to UEFA qualifying.
So, the idealist in me wants to believe in this sort of, oh, every team in Europe competes on equal footing in the qualifiers and it's the same for everyone. But I was just looking a bit at the numbers here yesterday. In the last 2 decades or so of qualifiers since the qualification stage for Euro 2000, San Marino has played 116 games, from which there have been 0 wins, 2 draws, and 114 defeats. the two draws for against Latvia in 2001 and Estonia in 2014. And during that period, they've scored 15 goals, but they've conceded 539. This is their averaging sort of almost 4.6 goals against per game. I mean, what is the point? It just doesn't serve a purpose. And I think, well, I can't understand. It must be better for in terms of their development as a team and from a footballing perspective if we have some sort of concurrent sort of group stage similar to Group D in the Nations League, where some of those nations that are quite far behind can play against each other and presumably have a chance of trying to play a bit of football in these games.
Ed, you and I both play amateur football to a not brilliant level, but to a not bad level. But in my league, when I was playing, you know, I wasn't put in a cup competition with the first teams because they were like semi-professional footballers and we'd have got battered. We were entered into a cup competition, we might win. And occasionally we did win and it was really great to win. You know, you had a cup final and you won it. I haven't thought of the practicalities at all, but the idea that smaller teams could be in a tournament for which there was a trophy, for which they could compete for, and maybe San Marino wouldn't have a great chance because, I don't know, Luxembourg are quite a lot better than them. But that doesn't seem like a stupid idea to me.
Yeah, and perhaps they could extend it just, you know, beyond Europe as well and have it for all the have a tournament that's specifically for countries ranked below maybe, I don't know, 150 or something like that. And you could qualify for that, you know, and it runs concurrently with as well as having a chance of playing in the World Cup as well, as discussed before. And I think, yeah, as Lance said, there's already a system of in the Nations League of them playing against each other, and that's definitely better for them, you know, having the opportunity to score some goals and not concede 10 every week. But yeah, I think there has to be something for them to aspire to. That's the key, isn't it? Because, you know, the Nations League, that's been quite good having a path for one of the smaller nations to get there. It makes it, you know, something to actually aim for, and perhaps a competition like you're mentioning just there, Max, would give them a real incentive to get better, and then perhaps, you never know, have a really good few years and even qualify for the World Cup or continental tournament.
Or even if you, I mean, I guess what's tricky is there are nations that don't qualify for the World Cup that you probably wouldn't put in the plate or whatever it is. I mean, I don't see why. I mean, I guess you need the money and the will and those kind of things to make it worth it for someone to organise it. You just, if you win the plate, you qualify for the next World Cup. I don't know. It doesn't sound like a daft idea to me. And then that would be sort of wildly celebrated and they'd really compete for that. I don't know what.
Yeah, I mean, well, in the next World Cup, there's going to be, well, they want there to be 48 teams, don't there? So there's certainly a place or two for a smaller nation, you know, somewhere, surely you'd have thought, because, as you say, it gives them a real incentive to try and improve.
The Tin Booney says, does the pod agree with the armchair pundits that only goals against Germany, Italy, France and the 1970 Brazil side should count towards a player's international goal tally? Harry Kane into the top four of English goal scorers, passing Jimmy Greaves, equal with Lineker. Lots of chat about whether these last seven goals are worth anything. I noticed when England hit nine, the commentator said the last time England hit nine away from home was in Luxembourg, where Jimmy Greaves and Bobby Charlton both scored hat-tricks in 1960. So I don't know, Wilson, like, historically, are these goals worth less than the goals of Charlton and Greaves and Hurst, etc.?
No. I mean, football changes over time. We know it changes over time. But there's always been good teams, always been bad teams. You know, Jimmy Greaves got four against Norway in the build-up to the 66 World Cup. At a time when Norwegian football was not as strong as it had become by the 90s. Hmm. I don't think anybody took that particularly seriously or said, you know, this is a disgrace that Greaves is artificially inflating his tally. Greaves got 10, I think, against Northern Ireland in four games, a 4, a 3, a 2 and a 1. Again, you know, it was at a time when Northern Irish football wasn't particularly good. You will always play smaller teams and you always play bigger teams. I think what is true is that there are more games now. But having said that, Harry Kane's done this in 67 games. Lineker, I think, took 80, Charlton 106 and Rooney 120. So he's scoring at a faster rate. And it's not that he hasn't scored against big teams. I mean, he has. He scored in the semi-final of the Euros. So, you know, and even if all his goals were against smaller nations, so what? They're still international goals. That's the way we count it.
Lars?
No, I was actually just stretching my hand.
Okay.
It's very confusing.
You've just bid for the house. Well, you've got the house. That's what it is. That's the way this auction works.
I guess Wilson kind of said it already. The thing about comparing to sort of games of yore is that you're right. There were bad teams then, and actually the teams that were, you know, if we go back 40, 50, 60 years, there'll be very sort of varying degrees of seriousness in football. You know, you'll have teams where people weren't full-time players, but they were still playing for the national teams. And, you know, teams that we now would consider good teams were maybe terrible back then, and we were all, you know, not alive, so it's hard for us to know. So I think that whole discussion is a complete sort of sidetrack.
Ed, did you have any thoughts about the game itself? I mean, I thought Smith Rowe's goal was nice. I liked Harry Kane's second penalty because it had a touch of the Pressman's. And I thought San Marino have a lovely kit.
They do. Well, the best two moments of the game were the two shots that San Marino had, I thought. That really got me out of my chair. Because one, when Ramsdale had to extend himself, it was quite an easy save. I think he just, you know, was making the most of his big moment. And the other thing, I felt a bit sorry for Tammy Abraham as well, because he scored a brilliant goal, absolutely brilliant goal from yet another Trent Alexander cross, inch perfect cross. But he also had one disallowed and got booked. Got another goal. Whose goal was it? It was Bellingham's first England goal, wasn't it? Got disallowed because of his stud caught a defender on the way through. And I thought that was a bit unlucky, really. I felt just a bit sad for him, even though he did score an absolute belter.
I did think the VAR that gave England their first penalty, the defender was like claiming for offside, and I just thought that was a terrible. It wasn't for me, you know. I don't know if anyone else was exercised about it at all, but I felt deeply for that San Marino defender.
Just don't stick your hand in the air. I mean, it's
Lars has learned the hard way.
I mean, we know if your hand goes sort of, you know, out from your body and the ball hits it, you're in trouble. And I suppose some San Marino players aren't used to playing with VAR, so maybe they would get away with that playing for Serie C teams or in San Marino. The one thing I would say about the game is it's mildly interesting when we went with a back three again, having done that against Albania, when we seem to have sort of settled into this way in the Euros that the back three was for teams where England thought that they might not control the ball. And the back, they played a back four when they were confident in controlling the ball. Whereas, you know, having playing the back three against San Marino and against Albania on Friday suggests that might be the default going forward, which I sort of think makes sense because, apart from anything else, it gets the best out of the very attacking right backs England have. And I think it's a system that's relatively easy to tweak according to who you're playing against without having to change shape. So if you think of the two players at the back of midfield, if you're playing, you know, a weaker side, you can play, say, I don't know, Calvin Phillips and Jude Bellingham. If you're playing a tougher side, you know, maybe Henderson comes in or Declan Rice comes in. You can make those adjustments according to opposition without having to make huge changes to the shape. And equally, the back three against a weaker side, you can probably play a fullback as one of the wide centre backs. Against a team where you might be under a bit of pressure, you can play the three centre backs. You can play Kyle Walker right wing back against a better side. If you're expecting to be dominant, you can play Alexander Arnold or Reece James.
Unless, of course, Southgate wasn't totally sure England would dominate the ball last night, and that's why he went
three. Yeah, I mean, I suppose he is an instinctively cautious manager.
He is, yeah.
I guess that is a possibility we have to consider.
Richard says, Northern Ireland and Scotland played competitive and interesting games tonight. Could you spend some time talking about those instead of having the, inverted commas, minnows and pre-qualifying chat all over again? Okay, Richard, you're going to really enjoy part two.
Richard will be delighted to know that I didn't even watch England. I thought this is complete nonsense. I can't be bothered. So I had Northern Ireland, Italy and Scotland, Denmark on.
Excellent news. We will test Lars on what he watched last night in just a second. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. November the 30th, a live show featuring Lars Sivertsen and Jonathan Wilson and Barry Glendening. Buy your tickets at theguardian.com/guardianlive. A huge halftime show yet to be planned. Will be good. Presumably Barry will tell some incredible story from his life, which we'll never forget. Involving bodily fluids or something, I don't know. If you can't watch it live, you can watch it anytime over the next week. Guardian.com/Guardian Live. We would love to see you there. Nick says, Max, Lars, assembled ladies and gentlemen, can you boogie? Yes, sir, we can. Rich says, do you think it's a little early to look forward to the England-Scotland game in the World Cup final, Max? I'm with you, Lars. I watched England for the first half and then I mainly focused on Northern Ireland, Italy, but had the Scotland game on and was watching when Che Adams scored that goal. And Ewan Murray, who is not one for hyperbole, said, that was absolutely fantastic. What a performance. Yeah. What a night.
The lesser spotted happy Ewan Murray. I mean, that's exactly. When you know. That's when you know. They were great. They played with tremendous intensity. They were looking to catch Denmark on the break and did that really well. The Danish coach was very complimentary of them after the game, and that was richly deserved. I mean, I have to, you know, bring my Nordic bias to bear and just sort of throw in that Denmark were missing quite a lot of players here. In the end, they had five maybe first teamers in the team, but like Kasper Juhlmann, the coach, said after the game, or said ahead of the game, that something like 15, 16 players were unavailable for his squad for this break. So they were a little bit reduced. You know, Yusuf Poulsen and Thomas Delaney had knocks, probably would have played if it was important, but they were rested. You know, Damsgaard's not there. Kasper Dahlberg has diabetes, so he's sort of taking a little break to figure that out. Højbjerg wasn't there. Like, there were a lot of people missing. But that shouldn't necessarily take away, I suppose, from the fact that Scotland are good. And Scotland just look good now. They have some good technical players in there, in addition to all the sort of the grit and energy you expect. And the goal scoring issue that they've had, I think Che Adams, I really like. You know, he works hard. He makes smart runs. He's very combative, and he's good forward.
And the atmosphere was so good. When I think Stuart Armstrong almost scored a third, I think Che Adams knocked it back, Ali McCoist almost exploded. I'm not sure if there's anything more. I sort of think if England were playing Scotland and Ali McCoist was commentating, I'd by accident start supporting Scotland. You know, he's got that sort of infectiousness about him.
Yeah, he really has. I mean, it's hard not to get, even as an England fan, it's hard not to feel, delighted for Scotland, actually, that they're in this position, and that they've got a really good chance now of getting to the World Cup, given that they've secured a home playoff. It's been such a long time. I remember the 1998 World Cup, the first game, Scotland against Brazil, and it's a whole generation of fans that haven't seen Scotland at the World Cup. So, yeah, let's hope that they can make it all the way now, because it's really tricky to get through these playoffs with the one-off system. But being at home is so important, I think, for them. And, you know, the atmosphere they created last night, they're going to be up for that again in a couple of months. Well, in March, isn't it, I think, the playoff.
So, Scotland are seeded for the playoffs. And Italy and Portugal both seeded as well. So a home game and avoiding those two. After Italy came second in their group to Switzerland because they couldn't beat Northern Ireland at Windsor Park. And again, the atmosphere was absolutely brilliant in this game. You know, you're just a shit San Marino, the Northern Ireland fans. They sang from sort of the entire game. And there were a couple of moments, weren't there? There was Conor Washington going through late on. There was this moment where Jamal Lewis, I think, was going down the left and he laid the ball across and there was nobody there for about 20 minutes. And then Stuart Dallas, who'd clearly been sprinting for about half an hour, got there and you thought, please put this in the top corner. And he drilled it wide. But Italy, that's a fascinating... To miss a World Cup and then to win the Euros and then to potentially miss a World Cup is a sort of, it's just quite odd, Wilson.
Yeah, it is. Just so you pick up on the atmosphere, I think Windsor Park is a great example of how you can take a sort of an old ground that was sort of falling apart and crumbling. And if you look back at Windsor Park in the 70s, I did a different podcast fairly recently on the game when Northern Ireland beat Yugoslavia in 1975, when they'd been exiled from Belfast for, I can't remember, 3 or 4 years, and Yugoslavia agreed to play them back there. And the atmosphere then looks amazing, but the ground looks atrocious. It's sort of all these sort of concrete piles and kind of wire fences. And they've done it up, but they've retained a lot of the character and they've retained the atmosphere. And I was sort of thinking this when you're talking about Scotland as well, that I know a lot of Scotland fans are quite down on Hampden. And it is obviously an old stadium, and it's maybe not the... It doesn't have the steep sides you sort of look for in a modern ground. But I have to say, every time I've been to Hampden, the atmosphere has been brilliant. And I would include the Sweden-Ukraine game in the Euros for that. So, but yeah, Italy. Apart from anything else, it shows how volatile international football can be. And, you know, sort of all that stuff we came out with after the Euros, Mancini's really tapped into this. He really understands how Italy work and he's able to affect games when it really matters. And that all sort of looks a bit daft now. I guess they probably still should qualify, but they have struggled for goals in this qualifying campaign.
Richard says, is it time the football landscape started respecting Switzerland more? They're always bemoaned at Euros and World Cups for just merely existing and making the round of 16. Yet they beat France, only lost to Spain on penalties at the Euros, have twice tied with Italy in this qualifying. Lars, I'm going to you as the Swiss expert. I don't know if that's fair on you or on the others.
I mean, are they bemoaned? I think they have an admirable sort of recent record over the last decade or so in terms of getting to tournaments and getting frequently getting out of their groups. I mean, it's a country of 8.5 million people thereabouts, and I think just qualifying regularly. I mean, they're a smaller country than Sweden, for instance. It's a pretty small country, Switzerland, and for them to be regularly qualifying for tournaments is a real achievement. So I think in general with Switzerland, we should give them more respect just for the fact that they've had a generation now of players who've regularly qualified for tournaments, which I think for the size of country they are, the size of population they are, should not be taken for granted at all.
I'm not sure who was on commentary, but they said after the game, no one will sleep tonight. The length and breadth of the country. I think hyperbole. I think that is slightly... I think someone in Switzerland didn't know the game was happening. Somebody went to bed.
Would he have slept? Sorry.
Maybe
Sepp. Still up now.
Sepp might have... I mean, he's probably got things on his mind at the moment, Sepp, hasn't he?
True.
I think. I don't know. I think I would never sleep if I'd been in... Blatter's position. You know, I'd always be expecting a knock at the door. This is sort of why I feel, you know, living on the straight and narrow.
What, another one? Yeah. It's been no shortages of knocks on the door there in the last few years.
All this doesn't look great for Wales because it means that they will probably be away. A draw should be enough tonight for them to be seeded, but not 100%. These playoffs, Wilson, like you were saying in the WhatsApp group, the standard of these players is going to be incredibly high. It's difficult, right?
Yeah, really difficult. I mean, only 3 of 12 teams to qualify is difficult anyway. But when you've got Italy, Portugal, Poland, you know, Scotland, who look good, Wales, Russia, North Macedonia, who I watched their game against Iceland on Sunday, and yeah, they look decent as well. So I think it's going to be a lot more fun than, for instance, Euro 2016. I'm really looking forward to these playoffs. I'm just sort of waiting for the draw and hoping there's some way I can sort of get myself out to one of these games. And I know there's a sense that because it's one-legged, that there's somehow an element of randomness there that wouldn't be there to the same extent in a two-legged tie. But I sort of quite like it. I sort of like the fact that there's a punishment for coming second in your group. It really does toss the thing into jeopardy. And I sort of thought that watching Portugal against Ireland on... When was that game? Was that Thursday, that game? And yeah, Portugal sort of seemed quite happy with the draw. And I sort of think, what are you doing? Like, Serbia are quite good. You don't really want to be going into a one-off game against Serbia, particularly not when Vlahovic and Mitrovic are in such good form. And yeah, they have paid for that. And I think that's quite a good thing. I think that makes qualifying a little bit more exciting than it has been.
It's been a really good qualifying campaign, and I don't agree with like Michael Owen, who said it was completely boring. I mean, the thing it helps to not watch England San Marino, I think. I also think with the World Cup qualifiers in Europe, they're a counterpoint to the Euro qualifiers in Europe, which now kind of are almost a bit because of half the teams go through. So there isn't really that much jeopardy for that many people involved. whereas here it's actually quite brutal. And I think that's part of the reason why it feels so much more exciting this time around.
It's worth talking about, you know, the moral dilemmas of Qatar, which we will do and continue to do. Amnesty have released a report saying reforms in Qatar have stalled with a year to go before the World Cup, leaving thousands of migrant workers trapped and exploited. Last year, Qatar passed two laws to end restrictions on migrant workers leaving the country or changing jobs without their employer's permission, which were widely welcomed. However, Amnesty has accused the authorities of complacency in implying the laws. A new report, Reality Check 2021, quotes one migrant worker saying she was threatened by her employer when she wanted to change jobs and told she had to pay 6,000 Qatari riyals, that's about £1,200, more than five times her monthly salary for a no objection certificate or else be sent home. Quote, apparent complacency by the authorities is leaving thousands of workers at continued risk of exploitation by unscrupulous employers, with many unable to change jobs and facing wage theft. That said, Mark Dummett, the Human Rights Organization's Global Issues Program Director, they have little hope of remedy, compensation or justice. After the World Cup, the fate of the workers who remain in Qatar will be even more uncertain. In a statement, the government of Qatar said it rejected Amnesty's assertion that labour reforms have not translated into changes on the ground for migrant workers. Systemic reform is a long-term process and shifting the behaviour of every company takes time. We got a question, actually, Ed, saying, how much would you respect from Niall? How much respect would you have for English football if they announced tomorrow they will not be going to Qatar? And then I thought, oh, I do want them at the World Cup. You know, like, I mean, like, it's complex, isn't it? I don't know if it is complex, but your emotions about football make it complex.
It is complex, but obviously, as an England fan, you're going to want to see your team play at the, you know, the most important tournament there is. But at the same time, there is the opportunity here to raise some of the issues that are, you know, everybody knows about in Qatar and beyond. And I think, you know, the England players, I know that they've been criticised in certain quarters already for when the subject came up. But, you know, that Conor Cody was talking about it this week, that they're going to be having a chat about what kind of line to take, what kind of stance to take when they're questioned about it. And I think that's quite sensible, really, because, you know, this World Cup is happening in a place where, you know, it's never been taken before, which is good in a way. But the way that we've got to this point is, you know, in terms of the venues and how they've been built and everybody knows about the conditions for migrant workers, that's not been good. So we have to highlight these issues when we can. And it's important that, you know, the players are thinking about these issues at least and not going blindly into them without thinking about them.
Well, I just think on that point, I think there's two slightly different issues there. So one is, I think it would be deeply unfair to expect individual players to do a huge amount of research on this and formulate their own opinion on it and take questions on it. I just think that's not their job and they shouldn't be expected to engage with that if they don't want to. If they do want to, we're brilliant. But I also think that rather than withdrawing, it is an opportunity for the FA or England as a whole to try and raise awareness and try and help people on the ground. And they, you know, they do have that threat of a veto. You know, they can say, well, if you don't let us do this, we're not turning up. And that is actually a major thing they can do. And also, there's not just that Amnesty report. There's also this case of Abdullah Ibais, who was rearrested yesterday morning. So he was, I think, sentenced to 5 years for bribery back in April and is appealing against that. And the suggestion is he's been rearrested because he's spoken to the Norwegian magazine Jossimar about his case. And he was a media manager for the Supreme Committee for Delivery. And as far as I understand it, like, I'd suggest people should probably go to the Jossimar website and read the piece in detail. But he's suggesting that there's sort of a top tier of workers of sort of about 1% of the total workforce who do have better conditions. And they're the people who get shown off to foreign visitors. So when David Beckham, for instance, wants to know about workers, he gets to see them, or he gets to hear from them, rather than the reality for the other 99%.
And this, I think, is where the key point from this Amnesty report now, which relates to that, which is very important, which is that it's one thing saying that Qatar has changed some of the laws and changed some of the rules. and are perhaps even enforcing those things for a small group of the workers, conditions on the ground don't necessarily change for the vast majority of them. And this is, I think, when FAs and people who are interested in wanting to see more, they're often shown the very sanitized part of it. And that kind of gives everyone an out, because I think a lot of people would just like to say, oh, well, it's better now, so we can just focus on the football and have fun. But it's not quite what's happening.
Also worth pointing out, Kick It Out's statement yesterday, as England qualifies for the World Cup, Kick It Out's announced the formation of Qatar 2022 Working Group. Coalition of UK organisations include Stonewall, the FSA, Football v Homophobia and Sports Media LGBT+. And we'll look at some of the key issues surrounding Qatar 2022 with a particular focus on LGBTQ+ inclusion. Qatar will become the first country in the Middle East to host the FIFA World Cup, but the nation continues to criminalise homosexuality. Sexual acts between people of the same sex are illegal, and trans people cannot change their legal gender. Punishments go all the way up to a decade in prison. Homosexual acts can technically result in execution, although human rights organisations are yet to find any evidence of a gay person being executed for the offence. This is the reality of life for LGBTQ+ Qataris. There's obviously a risk to LGBTQ+ fans and players who may wish to travel to Qatar for the tournament. A 2021 danger index created as a guide for travellers rated Qatar as the 8th most dangerous place to travel for queer people. So we'll chat to Kick It Out about that at some point before the World Cup starts.
There's another far less important, far less serious issue with Qatar, which is there doesn't seem to be any accommodation at all. A year to go till it starts. And if you go to booking.com, there's not a single hotel room in Doha available for the duration of the tournament. And Airbnbs were going for up to £15,000 for the month for a 2-bedroom place. So I don't quite know how they're going to resolve that. Because, you know, one of the good things about the logistics of it is that, yeah, every stadium is within sort of 45 minutes of the centre of Doha. One of the bad things about logistics of it is every stadium is within 45 minutes of the centre of Doha. So everybody is going to be trying to stay in the same place. And I don't quite know how that's going to be resolved.
Worth pointing out on the LGBTQ+ issue, the Government Communications Office for the State of Qatar has previously said Qatar is a welcoming and hospitable country. We view the 2022 World Cup as a precious opportunity to bridge cultural divides and to serve as a unique platform for bringing people together. We look forward to people from all over the globe converging on Qatari soil of different ethnicities, languages, religions and cultures, uniting through a shared passion for football. Although, as Wilson points out, also as long as they have a shitload of money so they can stay somewhere. That'll do for part two. We'll be back in a sec. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Now, we're going to be recording a special episode soon on what it's like to be a woman at football. The idea for the episode was sparked by a listener, Sarah, who wrote to us regarding our coverage of Cristiano Ronaldo, imploring us to have a more in-depth and nuanced conversation about a woman's experience watching football, something that we think is an important thing to do, especially with the recent announcement of research by the FSA that revealed that 1 in 5 women reported unwanted physical attention at football matches. We'll be speaking to Sarah for this episode. We'd love to hear from as many listeners as possible and your experiences at football grounds, watching in pubs, travelling to and from matches, etc. We'll be able to keep people anonymous if you wish. I won't use any of your experiences without getting your permission beforehand. There'll be a link to where you can send us your experiences on the Guardian website. I'll tweet it out as well. We'll be collecting stories for the next week or so, and we'd love to get any contributions on that. If you are listening before midnight on Tuesday, you can vote for us in the FSA Awards, nominated for Podcast of the Year. Plenty of other awards going for Guardian writers, the brilliant Susie Rack, the excellent Johnny Liu, both up for Writer of the Year, along with Jonathan Wilson, David Squires for Best Cartoonist, The Guardian itself, we're all nominated, and also vote for Ali McCoist because he's great. You go to @WeAreTheFSA for on Twitter, just Google FSA Awards, and it's thefsa.org.uk, which is a website you should look at anyway, because it does lots of good things.
You say Squires is nominated for Best Cartoonist. I mean, he's nominated for Online Media of the Year, so all of them.
Yes.
So it's Squires versus all of the Athletic, and
come on, Squires.
I think he can do it. You know, that's the kind of underdog I can root for.
Yeah, well, David Squires did have to go through pre-qualifying to get into.
Who did he have to knock out? Did he have to like a playoff
the
with
Beano.
Swiss Ramble?
Yeah, absolutely. go on, Squires, you can do it. Now, South Africa are set to make a formal complaint about questionable decisions made by the match officials in Sunday's 1-0 defeat by Ghana, according to their FA chief. They needed a draw to reach the third and final round of African qualifying. Ghana won with a controversial penalty, which, Ed, was a staggering decision, wasn't it?
Yeah, it really was. And you have to feel for Bafana fans. I used to live there for a couple of years, so I've always had a soft spot for them. And they were really in control of it, and they looked like they were going to progress. And then the referee intervened, and it was one of those decisions that you just, I think everybody was just still kind of trying to understand what he was giving. Unfortunately for them, I don't think complaining about it is going to have much effect, unfortunately.
Yeah, the match officials have decided the game, which is not what is supposed to happen, claimed South Africa's FA chief executive, Tebogo Motlanthe. We'll be writing to both CAF and FIFA to investigate how the game was handled and secondly to challenge some of these decisions. We've already registered with the match commissioner that will be making a formal complaint. Ed, are you across how African qualification is going in general?
Yeah, it's a really big day today, actually. By the time people will be listening to this, I suppose all the matches will be getting underway. We were talking about European qualification, how it's been quite a good campaign and it's been quite exciting at the end, because what's happened same in Africa, that most of the groups of the two best teams are having a showdown now. So today we've got quite a few really big ones, especially, I mean, the biggest one for me is definitely Cameroon, Ivory Coast. Ivory Coast a point ahead. They've got to go to Yaoundé to play Cameroon. And Cameroon, if they win that, then they would knock Ivory Coast out. And there's a few more matches like that. And the Cape Verde have got to play Nigeria. They're both at the top of the group. But Cape Verde are going to have to win that one to get through.
Nigeria were terribly against Liberia at the weekend, so I wouldn't be fancying Nigeria at the minute.
It's really exciting that it's come to this, and I have to say, I think African qualifying is probably the toughest there is. I think you have to get through all these games, and then you have this playoff of death at the end, basically, which is two legs. But it's
there's 10 groups of four. The top team goes through, and then there's just five matches. So there's five seeds, five non-seeds. And this is a two-legged straight knockout. Winner goes through the World Cup and losers go out.
Mm. And it's really tough. And obviously they've got the AFCON as well coming up in January. So it's a really massive few months for all the African nations.
Ed, remind me when AFCON begins and kind of what the impact's going to be on the Premier League.
So yeah, it kicks off on January the 9th in Cameroon. And the impact, the interesting thing really is when players are going to be having to join up with the national teams, because the FIFA rules say it has to be 13 days before the opening match of the tournament, not the individual country's opening match, the first game. So technically that would be the 27th of December, which takes out quite a big chunk of Premier League fixtures, obviously. So I was just doing something on this yesterday, and Liverpool, for example, obviously they've got Salah, Mane and Keita. They're playing Leeds on Boxing Day, and then they're playing Leicester on the 28th. So obviously, if the players were to, if each country was to call them up as when they can, then they'd miss those games after Boxing Day. But I think there's some negotiations going on at the moment behind the scenes, which are obviously going to have to step up in the next few weeks, as to when certain players will be joining up. And the key date in terms of the title race, really, could be Liverpool-Chelsea, which I think is on January the 2nd. And I think that there's, obviously quite a few players there from both sides. Chelsea have got Ziyech and obviously Edouard Mendy. So I think they're hoping that they can come to some agreement with their respective countries and join up with the national teams later. But that would be only just over a week before their first game. So I'm not sure whether that's going to happen.
Yeah, I mean, all that's true. And yet you look at the plans for the World Cup and there's a round of Premier League fixtures 8 days before the World Cup starts. So FIFA aren't applying that for the World Cup. How they can think they can enforce it for the Cup of Nations, I'm not sure.
Well, that's probably what the clubs are going to argue, isn't it, in the next... And, you know, they could be away... Well, if you get to the final, I think the final's on February the 6th.
Yeah,
and
that's right.
So, you know, if you make it all the way there, then that's a massive chunk of the season missing. Potentially six Premier League games, two FA Cup games.
Because also I think it's very hard to come straight back and fit straight back into the Premier League. I mean, I say that even as a journalist, it takes you a couple of weeks to readjust. So
when you come back, that first article you write about Laguna Solskjaer is going to be it's not quite as consistent as the last 25.
Yeah, I was disappointed to hear the savage attack on my Solskjaer industry yesterday.
What did Barney say? What did he call it? Churn.
Well, no, Robin called it churn and then Barney underlined it.
It's all done with love. Ed, I've noticed you have a podcast on the subject of African football. Can you sell it to all of us, please?
Yeah, well, thanks for mentioning it, Max. Yeah, I've just started up. It's called the Made in Africa podcast, and it's talking about players who play in the Premier League from Africa, related to the book that I wrote a couple of years ago. And yeah, so far we talked about Patson Daka, Enoch Mwepu from Zambia, Mohamed Salah, and the latest one was about Wilfried Zaha and his future on the international stage and at Crystal Palace. And yeah, it's just an opportunity really to talk about a subject that is underrepresented potentially. And yeah, no one's really done it before. And there's so many different things that we're going to broach and going back in time, hopefully, and having a few guests on, a few older players that are just trying to line up that at the moment. So yeah, thanks for mentioning.
Brilliant. Well, that's all right. We've recently discovered that we're big in Zambia. So the if you are anyone anyway, Zambian family, go and find it. Made in Africa. It's called wherever you get your podcasts, I presume.
Yeah, it's on Spotify, Apple, and Google.
Great. All right. Good luck with it. We all send our best to Louis van Gaal, who was cycling near the team hotel on Sunday. He fell, was taken to hospital for tests. He did his news conference via a video link while sitting in a wheelchair, used a golf buggy to oversee training. Physically, I'm not good, he said.
Well, some kind of buggy. I'm not, whether it's golf, I mean, it's clearly a buggy of some sort, whether it's golf specific or not. I mean, he said... I like this quote. It says, physically, I'm not good, but the brain is still working. So Van Gaal's brain is still firing at 100%. And this game against Norway tonight is going to be, listen, most likely thing is the Dutch win and it's not that dramatic, but there's a lot going on. There's the Van Gaal stuff. It's going to be behind closed doors because the COVID situation in the Netherlands. And the Dutch goalkeeper, Justin Bielov, is out of the squad after not being deemed fit enough to play. So it's like Tim Krul has been called into the squad as a replacement. Jasper Cillessen might start. We'll see. Of course, Norway's missing Erling Haaland and the very important Christoffer Ayer. So crucial game with a lot of people missing and weird stuff going on.
And not the first time this has happened to Van Gaal. Because when he was manager of AZ, he decided to demonstrate the pole vault in a school hall to some children while wearing leather shoes and broke his leg. And
of all the things to try and demonstrate in leather shoes, I mean, pole vault
indoors.
I also have to say, of all professional managers, if you want to go through them and see who do you think would make a decent pole vaulter,
yeah,
it isn't Van Gaal. I mean, that isn't the first one you'd go to, really.
I would love to see
15 years ago, so I guess he'd have been mid-50s at the time, but still. But yeah, he definitely had to take some RZ training from a buggy.
Yeah.
So he might have the buggy still from then, from those days.
Jurgen Klopp could be a long jumper. You can just see him, you know, bespectacled still. Like, you know, like the sort of Huey Teep, Ed Moses, glasses-wearing athlete at the end of the run-up doing that, the clapping over his head. I think Klopp is your most likely high jump / pole vaulter. Although very different disciplines, I would hate to insult You know, we now have Olympians listening to us. Almost certainly, Sergei Bubka will get in touch to to criticize this section of the pod.
On the subject of Olympians, I mean, we do have an elite level ski jumper who listens to our episodes in Halvor Granerud, who has not, to my knowledge, been to the Winter Olympics yet, but hopefully will do in the future. So if he does qualify for, if he does go to the next Olympics, we should all root for Halvor Granerud, because ski jumping is completely terrifying.
Could we sponsor? Could we could we get a little bit? Do they do sponsors on their shirts or when they're on their sort of salopettes? Could we get a little football weekly logo
underneath the skis?
On the skis,
underneath the skis.
Absolutely
when
right.
When it's in the air.
Would he let us do a big picture of Barry on the bottom of the skis? And we don't tell Barry.
A slim Barry.
He doesn't tell. Barry. A slim Barry stretch all out the way down the ski, and we don't tell Barry. And then we tell him to watch, and we just hope he watches the Winter Olympics and sees him on the bottom of the skis. Possible?
I hope so. I think any listener who doesn't know ski jumping or ski flying, do look it up on the internet. It is one of the most terrifying sports in the world. And anyone who can even do it, never mind be good at it, I think we should respect a lot.
This is from Devin, who says, "Hello, my name is Devin. I've been a big fan of the pod for the last 3 years. I'm one of your many listeners out here in the good old USA. And I know you don't discuss CONCACAF very often on the show, but I'm hoping you'll indulge me. I have a serious bone to pick with Lars Sivertsen regarding commentary he gave in response to a listener question about the US men's national team on October the 14th. Answering a question about the quality of Greg Berhalter following the team's loss to Panama, Lars claimed that the US team from the World Cup in Brazil was better than the current squad. I want to give Lars the benefit of the doubt and assume he was referring...
Yeah, I stand by that one.
I presume he was referring to the starting 11 from that game and not the current crop of US players. But I need a clarification. Maybe I'm just an overly excited American buying way too much into the hype we get from our own media, but we never in our history have had as many players representing the caliber of European clubs that they currently represent, especially at such young ages. He sent me a list of players. Pulisic, 23, Chelsea, Stefan, 26, Man City, McKennie, 23, Juventus, Gio Reyna, Tyler Adams, John Brooks, Sergio Dest, Yunus Musa, Conrad De La Fuente, Timothy Weah. The list goes on. Am I crazy or is Lars just wrong? Please discuss. Feel free to address this question whether or not Lars is on the pod to defend himself. Time is of the essence as the US just claimed a third consecutive victory over Mexico to go top of CONCACAF qualifying. I'd hate for this question to get answered after the game against Jamaica should we lose. Regards, Devin. Lars.
Oh, but they're doing well now. No, I think the age point is the key here, right? Because I think if you look at this crop of players, there are a lot of players who could grow into become very good. And I think there's a case to be made that Pulisic is the best ever American footballer already at 23. But it's an uneven crop, I think it's fair to say. And I think a lot of these players who are young, as you say, have a potential great future ahead of them. I think what's going on now with Ricardo Pepi is very exciting. I mean, we'll be seeing him in Europe soon enough. But I think in terms of the overall, I think if the teams played tomorrow, the current crop is likely to get beaten by the team they had in Brazil. But I think the ceiling for this group of players is probably higher. That's where I'd end up. Yunus Musa is very good as well. I like him a lot.
Jason says, "Dear Max, Barry and everyone, you seem to receive a number of emails from people listening to you as they work on their PhD. So you can add this to that pile. I'm sure this is not helpful while you're doing a PhD. Firstly, I hesitate to point this out since the other snippets from Barry's Wikipedia page have been removed for being largely unsourced trivia. But this great bit has so far survived in the personal life section. As a young man, Glenn Denning often accompanied his father on farm visits where he held the noses of cows while they were tested for TB. It was his job to open and close the gates, a task he thought beneath him. I guess that's still there because that is actually true. Second, as someone who also reads and writes words for a living, I share the pod's love for pedantic semantic debates a la volley versus half volley, today's discussion of ear plugging versus ear cupping. So I feel obligated to share that my skin crawls when multiple times per week Max says the tagline, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. Surely a podcast with the name Weekly should only come out once per week, no? Perhaps this has been debated before my time as a listener. All the best, and thanks for your great work, Jason." I feel, I don't know if anyone else has any strong feelings about this, but it's, you know, the brand is set now. And I believe it was set, apparently this podcast used to exist before 2017. But I feel it's too late to change. I don't know, Wilson.
Yeah, it's like the word fullback. That it made sense when it was given the name initially, which I believe was 2006 when it did come out once a week. And then that was on a Monday, and you got Football Weekly Extra on a Thursday. Mm-hmm. And the use of extra suggested that there was an awareness that twice a week was not weekly. But now, you know, we do sort of free form three times a week. Nobody's entirely certain when it's coming out. Sometimes John Barnes is on, sometimes he isn't.
Couldn't we just call it tri-weekly? The Guardian Football tri-weekly?
But we haven't changed the name of fullbacks now that they're no longer the... Yeah, their job is certainly not anymore to be fully back. We accept that sort of, as a vestige of a previous incarnation. That's how language works, right? You get my surname, Wilson, son of Will. Well, my dad wasn't called Will, he was called David.
It's true, my father was not named Steve.
Somewhere along the line, though, someone was called Will.
And Football Weekly was once assigned weekly. You know, things change.
Yeah, interestingly, I did recently do the radio show. The question on the radio show, you know, we need to modernize football phrases. We were discussing square pegs in round holes. And I was suggesting, I don't know how many people use pegs on a regular basis now. And it was suggested that should be, he's putting HDMI connectors into USB sockets. Would really, the kids would then...
Yeah, can I just say, I was slightly, I was unhappy with that. It doesn't work. Because you can put a square peg into a round hole. It won't work as well as a round peg, but you can force it in and it'll do a job. Whereas if you're putting the wrong connector in, it's either not going to fit or it's just not going to connect. So I think the analogy is broken down.
Randall said, I'm a bit late to the party. The phrase great servant to the club could be modernised to, he's been a great 0 hours contract worker to the large multinational brand. Stick it in the thermo mix was quite a good one. Anyway, who has a stable and a horse these days, said Tom. You know, you should say he's installed antivirus software after his hard drive has been corrupted. I could carry on with these, but you know, perhaps it's another pod. That'll do for today, won't it? Thank you, Lars.
Thank you.
Thanks, Ed.
Cheers, Max.
Thank you, Wilson.
Cheers, thank you.
We'll be back on Thursday.
This is The Guardian.